Do you like Facebook? How can a free service like Facebook cost us plenty? Financial planner Kevin McKinley will share some financial downsides of Facebook during this edition of On Your Money. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Tuesday, May 15th. Also coming up, advice to help your parents figure out their finances and how to get the most out of Medicare, and answers to your personal finance questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Make that On Your Money at wpr.org. It's information and advice on your money with certified financial planner Kevin McKinley. Managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, he joins us from our studios in Eau Claire, I think. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, Joy.
I'm very happy to hear your voice.
And me, you.
All right. You don't have a Facebook page, do you, Kevin? I was looking for one.
No, I'm going to stick with my GeoCities page. It's worked for me since 1996, and I'm a vintage kind of guy, and I think it'll come back into fashion sooner or later, and then I'll look like I'm a real forward person by staying in the mid to late 90s technology-wise.
Well, I'm so out of it, I never even heard of that. So, in any case, I heard that there are some people who think Facebook is just a fad, too, but, I mean, Facebook is... What do we have? There's like... 10 billion people are on Facebook?
Yeah, 10 billion people. It's not just confined to Earth. There's 50% of the interplanetary system is also on it as well. Now, Mark Zuckerberg, who is the so-called founder, but if you saw the Facebook movie, you know that this wasn't all his idea, but he's the one who is the current CEO and is credited as being the ersatz founder. He turned 28 yesterday, and his service, Facebook, is going public probably next week at a valuation of $100 billion with a B dollars.
Wow.
Which makes the market capitalization worth more than Disney and Kraft and Ford Motor Company. But one of the things that we have to think about is this free service and others like it, whether it was, you know, Hotmail or Yahoo accounts or Google or even Apple's system. A lot of these companies get their revenue from advertising, and one of the rules of thumb is if you're not paying anything for a service or a product, you are the service or the product, and your information is being sold to advertisers. And the greater these valuations grow of these companies, the more likely it is that they have to press their so-called free users for monetary value to the advertisers or to the company. But even with that, the numbers of Facebook are amazing. As we mentioned, $100 billion in valuation. There are 900 million registered users. That's about one-eighth of the people in the world, and about a quarter of the people who have internet access have a Facebook account. 500 million people log on each day. They spend an average of about 10 to 15 minutes per day. About 300 million pictures are uploaded to Facebook each day, and about 1 billion comments are put on Facebook each and every day. Of course, most of those comments are getting coffee. About that level of usefulness.
It's my birthday. Why do you say that this free service can cost us plenty?
Well, it can cost you a lot of things that don't seem... I mean, let's be honest. If you, based on the valuation, even of the users are worth maybe, you know, $10 a piece or so to the company. And for that $10 that you're getting for free of this service, there are a lot of things that can go wrong that can have a much bigger cost to you. First of all, you might lose a job offer. The AP has run a couple stories, and it's been repeated several other places, about employers or potential employers asking job applicants for the password to their social media accounts like Facebook. Now, if you get a job offer and that's the only thing precluding you from taking the job, I'm not sure that I would want to work for a place that would do that. And several states have passed laws already that prevent employers mm-hmm. from asking for that information. But even with that, several HR people have admitted to Googling job candidates to see what else is online. And for job candidates who are going to be working with the public and may comprise a potential embarrassment to the organization, those employers are hiring investigators to search online for people for damaging information that may come out and, again, embarrass the employer down the road. So if you want to prevent that from happening to you, you may want to Google yourself and delete or block any items and pictures out there that might be causing some consternation for you or your employer down the road. And if you are going to use a social media page for your professional front or communication, you may want to go to LinkedIn and keep Facebook only for your close friends and your family.
And you might not want to put that picture of you with the lampshade on your head on your Facebook page.
Actually, if I do get a Facebook page, that is going to be my avatar. It's an improvement. It makes me look like I'm irreverent and irrelevant. No, irreverent. That's what I'm doing.
Yeah. So a potential employer might not like your Facebook online presence. What else might Facebook cost us?
It could cost you your current job. About half of people admit to logging into Facebook during the day, and about a quarter admit to spending more than an hour per day on the page. Now, it's one thing just to spend the time alone, and keep in mind, if you are connected to a server network someplace, your boss can get the records of how much time was spent on the page with Facebook open, the amount of activity. Even if you've privatized your page, they can't see the content, but they can see you spending a lot of time on the page. What can be even worse for you is if you make comments about, oh, I hate this job, or these people I work with are idiots, something that a lot of people feel, obviously not those who work for Wisconsin Public Radio, but other organizations, they feel that. They express it on Facebook. They think they're talking to friends. The comments either show up or they're reposted by other people who are friends of theirs on Facebook, and it can mean a lot of headache and hassle for you and potentially losing your job down the road. You can also bring a virus onto the company's IT system through something you might download, an app or something that you use on Facebook. And finally, even just the like button may cost you your job. Six workers in Virginia were fired by a sheriff's department because they liked the Facebook page of the sheriff's opponent in a recent election. And the federal court judge ruled that a like button, in his opinion anyway, was not First Amendment protected speech.
Oh, my word. That's terrible. You know, at this job, I like a lot of things because I'm following a lot of different news sources. And so I'll like organizations and politicians from all over the political spectrum. And mm-hmm. I hope it's not viewed as personal likes or dislikes. You know, it's that's terrible, though. But whether at work or not, a lot of people spend a lot of time on Facebook, so we waste a lot of personal time, not just work time, on this.
I think so. And the average user, it can be a little bit of a distraction. And like I said, the average time spent on it is about 10 to 15 minutes. Most people look at it, see if there's anything interesting, maybe post a comment or two, and then get on with their day. But for a lot of people, just looking at it once can be a huge distraction. There was a Psychology Today study that tried to look at multitasking students. They said, focus on this task, but do whatever you want with your other social media. And they found that the ones who did not check their Facebook page were generally much better students. And they found that the people who checked their Facebook page once, even in a 15-minute period, were basically gone for the entire project. And they said because it was so distracting, they could look at things. There's always something to look at. And therefore, that the people who checked their Facebook page wasted a lot of time on it. One thing you can do if you find yourself spending too much time on Facebook is try taking the notifications off. Not only will you know, you can go back into it and check and see if your friend is actually getting coffee, if the coffee was got, but otherwise you won't be distracted by game requests and another friend requests and little items and updates for it. You can look at it on your time rather than being pulled away from the computer. And by not spending a lot of time on Facebook, you may actually feel better about yourself at the end of the day as well.
Why do you say that?
There have been several studies that have shown that a heavy use of Facebook can cost you your self-esteem. The University of Gothenburg in Sweden found a correlation between high use of Facebook and low self-esteem. Now, that's not causation. That could be a chicken and the egg issue. But other studies have found that especially people who look at other people's updates, you know, when you put an update on your Facebook page, it's generally going to be fairly positive. Well, it's easy to look at everyone else's updates on the Facebook page and feel like, wow, they have a great life. All I see is good news from all these people, whereas my life basically stinks because I have the normal life for it. And they actually found that people who view the updates of other people have a lower self-esteem afterwards than people who don't pay any attention to the updates at all.
Yeah. Just understand that all those other people who have those fabulous, glamorous lives are probably not telling the truth.
No, and for good reason, because if you were a big drag on everybody else and only talked about the terrible things going on in your life, who would actually come to your Facebook page? No one would want to read your updates. They'd block you. They'd defriend you, making your life even worse. So it's understandable why people would just put positive information up there. But if you perceive that as being what their lives are actually like, you think that all they do is, sit on the beach with their kids all day. We all know that that's not the case.
Yeah. And a little bit later in the program, Kevin, you'll have some tips on cleaning up our online identities.
Yeah, there's some good reasons to be doing that, and there's some things you can do to make sure you're still getting the use out of all these free gizmos and gadgets, but you're protected down the road and hopefully a lot happier and more productive.
Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for everyone. Investors should consult with their financial advisors prior to making any investment decisions. If you have a question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org, or you can post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network. And it is time now for the On Your Money email bag. And Mother's Day was just this past Sunday, and in honor of that celebration, we'll answer a question from Chuck, who says, "My father passed away, and I'm very concerned for my mom's financial situation. They were both retired and have money from various savings, investments, pensions, etc. But I wonder, what are the key points and dangers when dealing with finances after a death?" Kevin?
Well, good for Chuck. This is not only a nice topic in the wake of Mother's Day, but also something that many people are going to be dealing with and who didn't expect this to be an issue when they were planning out their whole lives, especially as they get closer to their own retirement. They generally become almost a caretaker of a single parent or married parent. And when the death of one of them can not only cause all kinds of emotional problems with loss of companionship, but there are some tangible financial issues that can come about. Loss of income. If a Social Security check or a pension check were predicated on that person being alive, that can go away or be reduced. The survivor might need some help in managing and monitoring all the bills and checks going in and out. And finally, just a good idea for in this situation, especially just to monitor the transition and help the widow, if you will, along as she tries to go through this, because this is one of the worst times of her life, I would guess. And being 80-something years old, I know that I won't be able to handle a lot of this information when I'm 80-something. I can't imagine that the average person is going to be looking forward to dealing with all this at that age as well.
Yeah, so what's the first thing Chuck should do, or anybody in Chuck's situation?
You want to change the account information, re-register it in the name of just the surviving parent or mother, if you will. Also, recheck any of the beneficiaries of the accounts, like IRAs or life insurance policies or annuities. Make sure they're all up to date. Chuck may want to add himself or another sibling on as a third party, or even at some point take control over the account if his mother is willing to give him control over the account. There are some other issues with that, but it does make things a lot easier to manage from that standpoint. You definitely, though, you want to see a lawyer, and there's a website called Elder Law that has a network of attorneys who specialize in dealing with these very same issues that Chuck and his mother are facing right now, and we'll have a link up to that website at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
So once you get that paperwork done, then what?
Well, then you want to definitely concentrate on where the money is invested, and there are three words to guide you in everything when you're investing for someone in this specific situation, especially someone who's maybe not as sophisticated and doesn't pay as much attention to what's going on. You want safety, you want simplicity, and you want liquidity. And those are three things that have nothing to do with yield or return, but it also means that it's easier to understand. It means that it's easier to get access to it, and it's unlikely that a butterfly flapping his wings in Greece is going to cause a 30 or 40% drop in his mother's net worth when she needs it, this money, more than ever. So we're talking definitely about CDs and savings bonds, maybe fixed rate annuities for a portion of it. I wouldn't be completely averse to that. Another thing that a lot of people don't think about at this case, especially when watching out for an older parent, is to freeze that person's credit report to make sure that crooks can't get her information and then open up credit that she won't be held responsible for it, but it's very difficult to clean this up afterwards. And so you can go to privacy.wi.gov to find out how to do that. And then also there's another nifty website called benefitscheckup.org. What it is a series of questions that you can answer about yourself or anybody else, and it will tell you what benefits, whether it's from the government or from the veterans programs or something, that this person might qualify for that you're not taking advantage of. And again, we'll have links to those websites at onyourmoney.com later on today.
And if you would like your question addressed during this segment of the show, the On Your Money email bag, you can email us anytime, onyourmoney@wpr.org. And you can also call us with your question right now, 1-800-642-1234. If you have a personal finance question that you'd like to run by Kevin McKinley, Certified Financial Planner, Managing Member of McKinley Money, LLC, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or send that email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.
Each one seeking happiness.
You're listening to On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine along with Certified Financial Planner Kevin McKinley. And we have a rare open line. If you have a personal finance question or a money matters question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Mary in Madison is with us first. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I have a question. I'm close to 62, and I'm trying to plan my retirement in the next 3 years. And I have a question for you about what kind of things I should consider in timing it. And one of the issues is I will have a bank of accumulated vacation, earned time, whatever. And when I do retire, that gets cashed out. And the question is, do I want to cash that out near the end of a year or right after the end of a year in terms of retirement? And I'm thinking to have that amount of money sustain me probably for about 6 months before I even have to claim Social Security.
Oh, great. Good question, Mary. And congratulations not only on being actually able to see retirement down the road, but also planning ahead for it. A big mistake a lot of people make is they don't think this far ahead and think about what it's actually going to look like and what steps they can be taking now, which can mitigate the damage that the loss of income can do to your situation. Mary, the vacation you mentioned, is that going to be taxable?
Yes, it's taxable income. And
okay.
See, that's kind of the what I don't know is how much would it raise the amount I might get in Social Security if I take it in a year that I've worked, versus the tax bite that I would take by having it really bump up my income that year, or should I wait until a year that I'm not going to work? And probably the immediate tax bite would be pretty significant, but I would get it back in terms of filing for the year.
I without knowing the exact numbers, I would guess it's probably going to be better for you, Mary, to actually wait, take the taxable vacation payments after the first of the year, the first January, if you will, after you've retired, because it's very likely that your income tax bracket's going to be much higher in the year in which you're working. And are you single or are you married?
Married.
Okay.
And my husband's already retired.
He's already retired, too. Okay. You might have a little bit more room that way, but I would still rather have you push that vacation payment into after the first of the year so that you – I would even tell you you're probably better off using savings and even pulling money, you know, from a home equity line of credit to live on to get that payment pushed out to after the first of the year, because I think you'll pay much less in taxes on it, and I really don't think it will boost your Social Security up enough to offset how much you might pay in income taxes on it, depending on the rest of your situation. But when you add that vacation payment onto your earnings that you'll have in your last partial year of work, the taxation of it will probably be at least 20% of it, and I'm guessing it won't be any more than that for sure in your year after retirement.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would think it probably would be at least 25%, maybe 30%.
Mm-hmm. That's the rate at which it would be taxed?
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, that makes it even more tilted in the favor of waiting until after the first of the year.
Okay, well, thank you. I appreciate that.
All right. Thank you,
Mary.
Good
luck, Mary.
Good luck to you. We go now to Matt in Dodgeville. Hello, Matt.
Hey, Kevin and Joy. My question is, I was with an employer for 10 years, and I had a 401k that I built up, and I was laid off from the job last May, and so now I've got this 401k with the old employer, and I'm just wondering, what do I do with that? Do I put it in some CDs, or what's the best thing to do when you lose your employer and you have a 401k that's built up? It's about $20,000, so just curious about that.
Was it just recently you were laid off, Matt?
A year ago.
A year ago. Okay. Are you working now?
I'm self-employed, so I do farming and websites and graphic arts freelance work. So I'm self-employed now.
The new America, farming and web design, right there.
That's right.
21st century and the 19th century, head to head. Good for you, Matt. Way to spread your skills around.
That's right.
There's only one reason I would probably keep that in the. Is the employer telling you that you have to take the 401k out?
They're giving me notices to cash it out, and it's in an ING retirement. I've got them in the 401k is set in a number of different high cap stocks, and I just, I feel like I should probably take a look at that, and I don't know if that's the best place to keep it until my wife and I retire in 30 years or whatever. I was always under the impression of maybe we should put it in like a credit. What are they called? The credit unions or in a CD or somewhere more secure in case something does happen with the economy.
And is your wife working outside the home?
No, she's a homemaker. We homeschool the kids. So.
Okay. I agree with your sentiment, Matt. You should probably put it into something that you can control. You know where it is at all times. And the nice thing about the CD is you're not going to make any money off the thing, but you're not going to lose any money on it. And it's difficult to get at that money in an IRA at any location, but it can be done. You will pay taxes and a small penalty. But by the nature of whatever it is that causes you to have to pull that money out in an emergency, it generally means you don't have very much in income. Therefore, you're not paying very much in taxes anyway, so the taxes on it won't be very high. The nice thing is it can add as kind of an extra safety cushion underneath you and your wife. So if there's a problem you run into with, your farming or your web design, graphic design, you've got some cash there that's not being affected by the rest of the economy. And then as time goes by, if things, get a little better for you and you can start building up more cash, then you can kind of stick your neck out a little bit. And whether you go to a bank or a credit union, there's probably going to be somebody there who's more than happy to try to invest that for you in some other places other than just the CD. But for the time being, while you make this transition and build yourself back up again, I'd like to see that money as safe as possible. And so, yeah, I agree with your sentiment. And if you go to that place and say, I have this old 401k, I want to roll it into a CD at your place, they'll generally handle all the paperwork for you that they can. You might have to initiate the transaction on the side of the credit union or bank, but generally they'll transfer it over on a wire basis and get the money into your account for you.
Yeah, that's right. And I know that the existing you know, ING, they have CDs and all those products. So, I mean, is there a recommendation on, you know, a type of CD or, you know, a longer period one? And will that actually grow a little bit at all on its own as a CD?
Yeah, with the long-term CD rates right now are just absolutely horrible. 2% on a 10-year CD is not uncommon. 1.5% on a 5-year CD is actually a pretty good rate. So you're going to be disappointed in that. But again, I'd like you to just to worry about the return of your money rather than the return on your money.
Good luck to you, Matt. Thank you for calling. Mike in Wisconsin Dells is with us next. Hello, Mike.
Yes, good morning. A wonderful show. And I always listen to it when you have the financial wizard there on your show.
But, very good, very good.
Yeah, so although it hasn't made me a millionaire yet, I'm still working on it. See, my parents, I've lost both my parents here within the last year, unfortunately, and they did have a bit of an estate, which we're working on through some attorneys. But my mom and dad kept probably every financial statement they ever had, all their tax records, all their credit card receipts. I mean, And very neatly organized. I mean, they're meticulous about that. But I have boxes and boxes and shelves full of this information. Is there any reason for me to retain any of this information at all, or can I have it all shredded and destroyed, especially like all their tax returns?
Mr. Wizard?
Let me just get my hat on with the stars and moons on top of it. Your best bet, Mike, is probably to save anything within the last 5 years. I'm sorry, how long did you say they passed away?
My mother, we lost my mother last June and my father the year before that, so.
Okay. Do you have any siblings or anybody else that might contest the estate, how it was settled?
Well, just my older brother and I, but he's actually helping me work through all this stuff, so.
Okay. Why don't you keep things, especially the recent things, for about 5 years? And that's just in case there's someone else who steps forward, they want to contest it or whatever. It's good to have whatever financial information you can have on your side. In terms of things, anything past that for tax reasons, whether you're alive or not, 3 to 5 years is usually the rule of thumb. That's about as long as the IRS can go without demanding an audit. But again, it's better off to have the stuff and not need it than to need it and not have it. So even though it can be a bunch of, you know, I've been a financial advisor, Mike, now for 23 years now, and I'm amazed at all the so-called, you know, great things that I think I do for my clients. One of their favorite things is when they bring me this box of stuff and say, what do I need to keep? What can I throw away? And what needs to be shredded? And I just, you know, I end up death by 1,000 paper cuts. But if that's what they want me to do and they value the service, I'll do it. So it is something that's out there. But I'd keep set about a 5-year limit on it. And then anything that has any cost basis as well, let's say they bought a stock back in 1995 or something, you want to have that cost basis on there just in case their old returns are ever audited. I doubt it will happen. You're certainly not the only person in the world going through this. So it's not something we hear about very often, but set a limit of about 5 years on it and you should be okay.
All right, great. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Mike, for the call and sorry for your losses. This is On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine with certified financial planner Kevin McKinley. If you would like to ask Kevin a question, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Time for Smart Assets and our continuing series on how to get the most out of Social Security and Medicare in light of the government's updates on those large social support programs. So, Kevin, I know that we covered Social Security, retirement, and disability. What are we going to do today?
Well, it's Medicare, and this is really the sticky one. None of these programs are in great shape, and none of them are easily fixable. But Medicare is the one that's the toughest to deal with because it affects every single person. It affects there's so much uncertainty. You know, if you qualify for Social Security, you get the check, and you get it until you die, and then if you've got a beneficiary, that person gets the check. But Medicare, you never know what's going to be covered, what you're going to need, when you're going to need it. You obviously have to be 65 years old and to qualify for it. It covers, you know, just about every basic thing and some surprising things out there for people who are over age 65. The latest report says the broke date is 2024, about 12 years from now. That's a number that moves back and forth depending on the system and the services offered and demanded. So we'd like to tell you what you can do now before you retire and what you should be doing while you're retired to make sure you get the most money possible for your health care.
All right. Well, what about those of us who are not yet eligible?
In your case, not even close. Plan for those expenses. Now, this is an alarming study that Fidelity, the financial services company, comes out with every single year, and it's always about the same number. But they take a couple, a 65-year-old couple, male and female, and he's going to live to 82, she's going to live to 85, and they say you need about $240,000 to cover just your out-of-pocket expenses for health care if you live from 65 to 82 and 85 respectively. Now, that sounds like a huge amount of money, and it is, but it represents the fact that if you're alive, you're going to spend a few hundred bucks a month out of pocket for copays, deductibles, uncovered expenses, etc. So that's not surprising. It just sounds like a lot of money when it's all added up. In light of that, you definitely want to use an HSA, a healthcare savings account, if you have the eligibility for one at your work. Usually they pair that with a high deductible plan. It allows you to build up more cash so that you can pull the money out in retirement tax-free for qualified healthcare expenses. Also, if you are nearing the age of retirement and you are under an employer-provided health insurance plan, if there's any procedures your doctor wants to have done, knee replacements, something like that, get it done now, because it's probably going to be a long recovery time anyway. It's going to be expensive, and you don't know if Medicare will cover that specific procedure and to what degree at that particular time. And finally, take care of yourself. Lose a little weight, eat a little better, get a little bit more exercise for, because you're going to be around a lot longer than you think you are, and you want to keep yourself in as good a shape as you possibly can.
What about for people who are getting close to 65?
You want to keep as much cash on hand. Definitely apply for Medicare at age 65, even if you do have some coverage. And also, you do want to get some kind of supplemental policy up on top of it. And I think there's 20-some policies, all those different letters Medicare has for it. People who are looking for coverage above and beyond, you do have to review those policies each year, because they do change every single year. One thing I run into a lot in my practice is a couple where one person is 65, wants to retire and get on Medicare, and the other one is not working but is under 65 and was using the older person's employer-provided health insurance. You can actually get that person on a COBRA plan and maybe even qualify for other insurance without a healthcare exam in this situation. And again, we'll have a link up to the webpage that describes that for people in those situation at onyourmoney.com later on today.
You mentioned that we need more cash in retirement for health care. How do we go about that, and how would that help?
Well, Medicare is a great program. People are actually very happy with it, and I'm always surprised that it becomes a political football, because I've had no one ever tell me, you know what, whoever raises the age of Medicare, that's the person I'm going to vote for. But it can only cover so many things, and medical technology is advancing much more rapidly than what Medicare can keep up with in terms of paying for. So I like people to keep as much cash on hand as possible, so that if anything does come up down the road for yourself or a loved one, that the decision is a medical decision, whether or not to have the procedure done, not a financial decision. So once you get into Medicare, and if there's a procedure that's recommended, if it's not covered by insurance or Medicare, ask what the price is and what it's going to cost you out of pocket. You do have the ability to negotiate. Sadly, no different than if you were buying a car. And I'd like to see people keep a home equity line of credit or get a home equity loan and even a reverse mortgage to help pay for these procedures and keep that money on hand so that it's there if you need it to pay for the cost. You know, people say, gosh, I needed this done. Medicare didn't pay for it. It cost $50,000. Well, that's money well spent. There's no glory to dying with lots of money, especially if everything else about you is right after the procedure is fixed. But the problem with getting better health care and having these things done is it extends your life, which then extends the overall cost of what you're going to be paying out of pocket for health care in retirement.
Kevin McKinley, Certified Financial Planner, is here to answer your personal finance questions. If you call 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Steve in Kenosha is with us now. Hi, Steve.
Good morning, Joy.
Morning.
Good morning, Kevin.
Hello.
My question involves refinancing. About a year ago, I refinanced, went from a 15-year to a 30-year fixed at 4.375. Of course, today the rates are lower. You still can get a 30-year today for 3.75. So the monthly payment would only go down about $60 a month. but with closing costs at $2,000, the break-even would be a little over 3 years. Just wondering if it would make sense for me to do it again.
Yes.
There you go. Why should he do it again?
Next caller, please. No, it definitely makes sense. I'm glad you're thinking about this. And it's not so, you know, when people talk about, gosh, this is going to cost $2,000 and it's only $60 a month, people don't realize how fast time goes by. 3 years ago, it was 2009. And 2009 seems like very recent memory. And the time will go by very quickly that you'll be staying in this home. And a lot of things that can happen in your life, especially as people are, you know, growing older, that extra $60 can make a big difference. And so I would definitely recommend that you do it, and especially if you think you are going to be staying in the home for at least a couple more years. The risk to doing it is very low. The reward to doing it is very high. I will say this for people who are going back to refinancing. The lenders are swamped right now. The process is very slow. So if you're thinking at all of refinancing anytime in the next 6 to 8 months, you want to start doing it right now because it is going to take a long time to get all of your information through it. And the nice thing about starting the procedure of refinancing is, yeah, it's a kind of a pain, it's a hassle, but you don't have to really, really commit to it until you actually sign on the dotted line. There's a lot of other work like appraisals, credit checks, et cetera, that need to go on before the refinancing can go through. It's good to get that work out of the way and then decide if you want to get it right when you're ready to sign on the dotted line.
Coming up during On Your Money, some tips on cleaning up your online identity and the website of the week, and more answers to your personal finance questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine with certified financial planner Kevin McKinley. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network.
Greenback paper bill. Yes, just a little piece of paper coated with chlorophyll.
With 5 weeks of spring left, we are spending a portion of the show each week to some spring cleaning items. And as promised, Kevin McKinley has some tips on cleaning up our online identity and activities. And Kevin, what do we want to do?
Well, you can generally get more efficiency out of these different programs, but definitely you're looking for more privacy and more control over your information, both in terms of what the public sees and what these companies do with it, and hopefully it makes it easier for you to use in the future as well.
So what is the first step?
Did you know, Joy, that 12 million Facebook users have yet to click on the privacy features? All of their Facebook information is still out for the whole world to see at any time. And not only that, but some of the people who are friends of theirs on Facebook, that information can be available as well. So definitely set your privacy settings so that only people who are friends of yours on Facebook can see the information. Mm-hmm. Also, if you have an iPhone or an iPad, that's another dangerous spot for people. I have an iPhone and I'm going to be getting an iPad, but it's something that with all those different apps on there, many of those have updates. And sometimes the updates as part of the system, if you say, yeah, go ahead and automatically update this, the terms of the service have changed and the terms of how they are going to gather data of what you use have changed. So block all the updates. Google Plus is a new kind of an interactive system. That's another one where they're trying to get lots of information from you about what you like and what you do, so that they can try to sell you more products for it. And most people would prefer that information is not released. So watch that. Definitely review this once every 6 months at least. Put all the privacy settings in place and then schedule a reminder again to go back in, update the program at all, but also look at all the different privacy settings, because what they'll do is they'll say, hey, is it okay if we do an update for this? And you won't realize that the terms have changed, where they're now gathering a lot more of your data that you can't find out about and can't block until it may be too late.
Well, I certainly knew about the Facebook privacy options, but not these other items. I'll have to check that out. Goodness. So what do we do after that?
One of the things that some more sophisticated people are doing with all these different great services out there is they're compartmentalizing or fragmenting out what they use each and every one for. Now, you know, on one hand, it's great to have all of your information on Facebook or all of it on Gmail. But other people are saying, you know what, I don't want all that information on one device. I'm willing to give up a little bit of convenience so there's more isolation of information. So use, Facebook for your social networking, LinkedIn for your professional Gmail for your email back and forth, and maybe use Microsoft Word or something so that for all your word processing and other issues. So you're using all the information is not in one place. It makes it a little harder to track for you, but it also means that one provider doesn't know every single thing about all that you're doing in your life and can take advantage of that knowledge.
Is there anything else?
The United States government, USA.gov, says they would like you to write a social media will. They just put up a blog account, so they said they want people to think about what they want done with their social media accounts if you should pass away, because this information lives on forever. And I think they're running into situations already where people die with a very important, let's say, Facebook page, and there were no provisions taken for what should happen to that. And the family says, hey, we don't want that up there. Or they might say, we want that up there, because a lot of friends posted really nice tributes on there. So they want you to write a social media will giving whoever is going to be the executive of your estate all of your usernames and passwords and accounts so that that person can decide what to do. And those people may have to provide a death certificate to the provider, Facebook, if you will, so that this person can then take control of the account, which sounds like a tremendous inconvenience, but it's something that you would want done in case someone tried to do it for untoward purposes.
Oh, my word. I never thought that actually is a good idea to have it in the will somehow. Because I still get birthday notifications from people who have passed away, and it's kind of sad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. For lots of reasons.
Yeah. Well, this is On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley, and we have time now for some calls. Louisa in Madison is with us. Hi, Louisa.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, what's on your mind today?
So I'll try to be concise about this. It's a little bit complicated. So my boyfriend and I recently bought a home, and we're planning to move in together soon. And the intention is to get married, you know, but not, you know, until a year and a half from now. So we put the home in his name only because he supplied the down payment and all of that. And then we figured once we're actually legally married, he'll add me to the title and everything. Our question is, we're wondering what would be the best way to go about things in, you know, until we actually do get married and I become an owner as well as him. So friends have suggested, you know, that, for example, that I should pay him rent, which seems kind of silly to me. And, you know, obviously I do plan on contributing to the expenses as well, but another friend of ours had suggested forming an LLC around the home. And, you know, originally we were just planning for me to just live there and take care of half of the expenses. But then I started thinking, well, for tax purposes, you know, you have to declare if you own or rent. And, you know, I wouldn't technically fall into either category. And so I was just wondering if there was a, you know, better way to do things
Sure. Well, let me ask you, Lisa, first of all, a very important question here. You said you're living in the house together and you're not yet married, correct?
Correct.
Okay, well, it must be at least a two-bedroom house then, correct?
Yes. Okay. Three bedrooms.
Good. Oh, my stars and garters. All right. Lisa, you actually have an issue here that a lot of people, of course, are facing, and it's not just people. How old are you, if you don't mind me asking?
I'm 32.
Okay. People 62 are going through this because, you know, they're on their maybe their second or third relationship, and for whatever reason, they're just deciding not to get married, but they do want to live together. And sometimes it is for convenience, and it makes financial sense that you can split the expenses of one household. You're spending a lot of time together anyway. Why not just put it together? But you're already being very wise and just saying, hey, wait a minute here. I want to do this, and this sounds like a good idea, and I'm for it, and I trust you. But I also recognize I'm bringing something to the table here in the form of finances and helping taking care of expenses, and I'm not, you know, getting as much benefit for that. The good news, Louisa, is it's entirely up to the two of you to decide what is right for the two of you. I have some people who cram everything together from day one, and they're perfectly happy, and I have a lot of other people who say, you know what, we can always do that. For the time being, let's keep these expenses here and those expenses there. I'm going to contribute X amount of dollars. I would say the rent issue in my hand, just from your perspective, boy, I'd like to see, if you're going to pay rent for that, I'd also like you to see eventually get some kind of equity built up in the home, or at least be, have the rent be substantially discounted over, you know, what a one-bedroom apartment in Madison would cost you for that. And I don't know if it's necessary to do an LLC. What I'd prefer that you do is maybe go to a lawyer and just say, well, let's draw up some type of domestic partner agreement so that if this doesn't work out for whatever reason, and all relationships either end in death or splitting up, which is neither one of those is good. But both of those events require some type of pre-established document that says if this should happen, we've already talked about who gets what when, rather than saying, hey, you know, we lived together for 3 years. I paid all that rent. It didn't work out. Now what am I supposed to do? You've got this, you know, you were using the rent to help make the mortgage payment, but he's got a good case too. He's saying, hey, I put the down payment in there. I'm just transferring that half of that equity over to you. So I would actually contact an attorney. There are people, especially in Madison, who specialize in these kind of domestic partner agreements that, who will can guide you through that. Go to lawyers.com and search in Madison. You can find a great listing of attorneys who will specialize in that.
All right, great. Thank you so much.
All right, Louisa, thank you for calling and good luck. So did Grandma McKinley used to say my stars and garters? That was good.
She was cooler than that. She was cooler than me, actually.
Joanne in Green Bay is with us now. Hi, Joanne.
Hi, good morning. I have a question about financial planners. I know that it's a good idea to diversify where we have our money. And my question is, do we also diversify with more than one financial planner?
Ooh.
We have one that we've worked with for many years that we're very happy with, but we have been approached by another one, and I'm not sure what would be best to do.
Kevin, you're not supposed to do that, are you?
Well, let me ask you this, Joanne. When you say we, are you married?
Yes.
Okay. If a gentleman approached you and said, hey, I see you have a husband, and you're apparently happy with him, what would you think about having a second husband?
No, thank you.
Okay. That's what I think you should say with a financial planner. That it's like trying to ride two bicycles. You really, it's hard enough to do it well and do it with one whom you really like. It's way more difficult if you have two of them. And it's not just philosophical. It can be financial. One financial advisor might buy something and the other financial advisor might sell something that could create a tax problem for you, a wash sale. And it's too hard for the right hand to know what the left hand is doing. So I think if you're fortunate enough, a lot of people don't have a financial planner they're happy with. If you're fortunate enough to have one already that you're happy with, I would stick with that one. And until the relationship changes, I'd say to the other one, say, hey, no offense, we're really happy with this one right now. But if anything changes, we'll definitely give you a call.
Thank you so much.
Joanne, thank you very much for the call. So, Kevin, what's the website of the week?
The website of the week, if you don't like Google for all your search engines, I happen to, but if you don't, you can go to DuckDuckGo. DuckDuckGo.com looks a lot like Google search engine, but they don't have nearly they're not nearly as clever at putting advertising up and getting your information. So DuckDuckGo.com is a good search engine alternative to Google, and we'll have a link to that website at our website, OnYourMoney.com, later on today.
Good enough. Time for four more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley, certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. He is with us just about every Tuesday at this time for On Your Money. And again, you can send us an email anytime. Maybe we will use it for the On Your Money email bag, onyourmoney@wpr.org. And I hope you are with us tomorrow at this time. We are going to be talking tomorrow about the joys and the benefits of summer camp for kids. I will be talking to the author of Homesick and Happy. And maybe you can share some of your own memories of summer camp. Or maybe you have kids in summer camp as well. That's tomorrow at this time. Thanks to Rob Ferret and to Bill Martins and to Cynthia Schuster for producing this program. And thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.